Back in the early 1980s, I remember Ford Motor Company rolling out this new tagline, quality is job one. And at that time, I don't believe I had ever heard a manufacturer use the word quality so prominently as Ford. And I remember back then when automobiles could roll over the odometer at 100,000 miles before any major repairs, that was a huge celebration. And now today, it's more of a common thing. You would expect that vehicle to last much longer. But back then, that was an anomaly. So now, an automobile manufacturer is making a commitment, Ford is making a commitment to build a better car, and others in the auto industry had to start paying more attention to building quality into their products rather than relying on inspections or warranty to fix what did not work. Have you ever wondered how this shift in our country to focus on quality manufacturing came to be? Have you ever thought about what or who really defines what quality is or how it can be measured? Today on the Building Sustainably podcast, we're going to answer these questions and also share with you how a commitment to quality and quality certifications in the home building industry is changing the way we build and deliver new homes today. Our guest today is Scott Sedam with True North Development, a quality consulting group out of Michigan that has worked with hundreds of builders around the country to help them become better builders, delivering a better home, and having strong trade partner engagement and participation in quality improvement initiatives. And Scott, you've been doing this with True North for over 25 years now, huh?
It'll be 25 years this summer, and started in the industry 34 years ago.
So Scott, I would like to get into your industry experience, but can you give me just an overview of how the quality movement came about? Because you were in that time frame, and you were with other companies that were bringing that on. What was the impetus? What really brought that to the United States and really got us going?
Well, if you go way back and look in the history, probably the first things that you'd really identify with the quality movement would have been two guys, Dr. Deming and Dr. Schuert, who in the 30s at Western Electric in Chicago started doing experiments on what resulted in better quality. And for those of you who aren't in my generation, Western Electric was the division of AT&T that made the most phone equipment of anybody on the planet. And one of their plants in Cicero outside of Chicago, I think they had 30,000 employees at one time. So it was a very rich environment. From there, it really moved into World War II. People don't think about this very often, but we did an impossible thing in World War II in this country. We fought two massive wars that would take everything we had, each on their own, on opposite sides of the globe. And people think about, you know, what all the soldiers did, which is incredible, and the pilots and the people on those lines. But the unsung heroes in World War II were the logistics and supply chain people. Think about that. You're on opposite sides of the world, and you have to get not just ammunition and equipment and weapons, but you also have to get repair parts and fuel, gasoline, diesel oil, food. Imagine feeding these millions and millions of people on opposite sides of the world and keeping that supply chain going constantly. Ironically, if you look today, I wasn't going to bring this in, but I think it's a good point. What's really bogged down Russia in this kind of insane attack on Ukraine was that their supply chains broke down, and they haven't been able to feed and provide even a fuel. So it just shows you in a microcosm, they couldn't even do it in neighboring countries effectively. Mm-hmm. Imagine what it took to do it in wars on opposite sides of the planet. And people like Dr. Deming, Dr. Duran, they were in the Defense Logistics Command, and they were the people who figured out how to get things to different places and worked with all the factories to turn out really high quality. And the quality of our vehicles and war weaponry and such was so far above and beyond what was done in the countries we were fighting them. So what happened was, after World War II, Japan was totally wiped out their industrial capacity. And we we just bombed it to nothingness. And they had to come back, really struggled to come back. And in the late 40s, early 50s, they got a hold of Dr. Deming, Dr. Duran, and started bringing them over to Japan. And they realized in the background what had happened and say, how can we take our limited resources and build a really a quality product and do it efficiently and intelligently? And the irony was that the Americans taught the Japanese how to do it. And the Japanese will absolutely confirm that. They don't argue that point at all. So they started taking off in the 60s into the 70s. And as the American cars got worse and worse and worse, these darn Japanese cars would come into the country and they ran forever and they worked great and they got good mileage. And we were in total denial about it. I'll never forget that my brother-in-law arriving to pick up my sister when they were dating. They were seniors in high school, and he came in his grandfather's little bitty Toyota that his grandpa had bought. And we were just making fun of him and just saying what an idiotic little car it was. Do you know what? That car really drove great. It ran great. And they had it forever. So what happened then was, and the irony is Detroit, and I'm sitting here outside of Detroit right now. I could be within a 15-minute drive. I could be to 10 different auto plants. Detroit made some incredibly cool vehicles in the 50s and the 60s, a little bit in the 70s, but they really started going astray in the 70s. They were cool. And you brought up a point, Tim, that I use in workshops all the time. The fact when I was a senior in high school, I probably shouldn't say this, it really dates me, but it was in 1970. And senior in high school, and my friend Jim Helms had a 58 Chevy, which was interesting because, the 56 and 57s were real cool looking. The 58 just wasn't as good looking, so it was cheaper. So Jim had a 58 Chevy, and it was going to turn 100,000. So we all went up the Willow Grove Road, about 20 of us, and the Willow Grove Road, not far from the high school in southern Indiana, was the drag strip. Because it was about a half mile long, dead straight. We're down there, there weren't many straight roads. It was pretty hilly. So we went and we pushed it the last mile because that was a big thing to do. Now, all doing a class, and I did it at NAHB this year, IBS. I had 250 people in the room. And I asked how many had a daily driver in their family or, business. A daily driver with over 100,000 miles that they don't worry about in one bit. And it's about 80% of the room raised their hand. It happens like that everywhere I go. Well, when I was a kid, you'd been lucky if you had one. So when people say, oh, they ain't like they used to be, and when it comes to our vehicles, well, that's a really good thing because they're so dramatically better. And how did they do it? It was the quality movement. And Ford was the first one. They woke up in the early 80s and saw what was happening and how the Japanese, and by the way, people talk about also the Germans and such. The Germans got their quality by what we call brute force, which is, constant inspection, continual rework. Okay. And that's how they got theirs at that time. So when you got it, a Mercedes BMW, it was a really good car. The Japanese did it very differently. They did it by getting everything right the first time, and everybody had the power. If anything was wrong, from laying down that first piece of the chassis or the first whole block of the engine, if anything was wrong, they could stop the line immediately and say, let's fix it now. We're not going to keep going and fix it later. And so what we started to see was a huge change. Now, I go back even before that in the 70s after grad school. I'll say it was in 1979, I went to Motorola. Motorola was the first winner of the Deming Prize as a U.S. company. Now, it was before National Housing Quality Award, which started in the 80s. Motorola was also the first winner of that. But the Deming Prize was for Japanese companies that exhibited the absolute top best quality. And I got the Motorola at a very heavy time. And what we realized was that you know, the scuttlebutt, what everybody said was, well, yeah, you know, well, they're doing it, but they're losing money. They aren't making any money. Mm-hmm. And we found that absolutely was not true.
Right. The full feeling that quality has to cost money. You got to spend more money to get quality.
Yeah. And it was a shock to everyone. You don't remember the thing people used to say? They used to say, okay, you can have, I got to get this right. You could have quality, you can have profit, or you could have speed.
Mm-hmm. That was the company's version. You could have quality, profit, or speed. The consumer was you could have quality, price, or service, but yeah.
But they'd say pick two.
They'd say you can only have two. Right, right.
What we found out, study them at Motorola, that was insane. Now, see, Motorola had been beaten out of the consumer product business by the Japanese. Bob Galvin, son of the founder, who is an incredible man, Bob Galvin saw it and said, we got to change or we're going to get beat out of everything we do. And so that was a very heady time in the late 70s and in the 80s at Motorola. Ford gets a lot of credit, but Motorola really was really more than anyone else, I'd say, led the country in that. And then I went off to a couple consulting firms. I would have liked to stay at Motorola because it was really cool what we were doing, but they kind of didn't know what to do with you if you didn't have an electrical engineering degree, which I didn't have that one. So a couple of consulting firms, we got very heavily involved. Florida Power and Light, a service company. I mean, they didn't sell any product, right? They were a winner of the Deming Prize and later a National Housing Quality Award. They started looking, how can we institute quality in the service we deliver? And they got it down to just the details of exactly how they bought their lift trucks, you know, what dimensions the booms were and the buckets and where the controls were, little details to enable their people to deliver the best possible service, which enabled them to deliver the best possible power dependably to their homes and to the customer. That's quality, right?
Yep.
So it evolved in that Ford got better and better. In fact, there's a cool story. You know, both you and I were at Pulte. Bob Burgess, who was president of Pulte when I got there, and I believe when you got there too, was still president. Yep. His father-in-law was a longtime top engineer at Ford. And he was absolutely ready to retire, wanted to retire. He was done, been there, done that. And he didn't have any interest in keeping working. He was just waiting for his retirement deal. And they came to him and asked him if he would be one of the top head engineers of the teams on the Team Taurus program, the Ford Taurus.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, the Ford Taurus. That was a big brand new model for Ford.
And that was what Ford focused on. At the time, people don't realize now, when the Taurus came out, it was radical. It was so strong in so many features. They benchmarked the best features of every vehicle on the planet, and their goal was to replicate that in the Taurus. Of course, they had to do it for a price, so maybe they couldn't quite do the Mercedes, but they were awfully close to it. And his father-in-law ended up working another 5 years after his planned retirement, because he was so excited and turned on because they were changing the industry.
Yeah.
So that was one of the reasons in 89 that Pulte, late 88, I came on there in early 89, went out looking for someone to start the Pulte quality movement, which I was hired for, because they had, Bob Burgess had personal experience of how this had changed a company. And Bill Pulte knew a lot of those folks too. So that's how
where Ben Pulte was based in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, right outside of Detroit, right? So there's that big connection to what's happening in the manufacturing industry.
Absolutely. The Pulte, if you look at the top Pulte guys at that time, You know, Burgess, Bill Pulte would have been the top two. I mean, almost all of their friends were people they spent time with were auto industry executives.
Yeah.
And so they'd keep hearing what was going on. And then GM started catching on and started bringing Dr. Deming to Detroit. And we actually had, I moved over to Detroit around Thanksgiving of 80. And I met a woman on the plane who was an engineer from one of the GM divisions. And we got talking about quality, and I had read all the Dr. Deming stuff, and she was amazed because she had read it all, and he wasn't that well known here. He was revered, almost godlike in Japan.
Right.
And she said, well, we have a Detroit Deming study group. We meet once a month because he comes to town to work with Ford, and now he's also starting to do some work with a GM truck division. And so we meet with him, and she invited me. Well, there was in this group, there was about 40 engineers, GM, Ford. There might have been a couple Chrysler, but predominantly GM and Ford, and one other person from outside automotive, which was me. And they looked at me like, you're from a home builder? What are you doing here? You know, what could a home builder know about quality? You know, and then when I would tell them I was from Pulte, let's just say at that time, things weren't going real well
with for Pulte.
Yeah. In most of the divisions, Bill had kind of got out of the day to day, and they had hired some super high level financial guys. And it was just at that time in the United States, it was a land play. You buy land, build it, sell it. Most of the money was being made on the land, not mm-hmm. on the product. And so the quality that was an afterthought, except for a few people. Guy that you and I both worked with, Mike Rhodes.
Yep.
Example.
Great guy. Great, great mentor.
Phenomenal. And I said, Mike still, I mean, you know, Mike Rhodes, you know, Gary Grant, Minnesota, those guys. And I named my five best mentors in my career, along with Bill Pulte. Those two guys are at the very top of that list. Well, Chicago, a division of Pulte, got involved in the quality movement. And they had read a couple of books. Phil Crosby wrote Quality is Free.
Mm-hmm. I read that one. I remember that.
Yeah. And there were other ones out there. I read
Tom Peters' Thriving on Chaos. That was my first book. My mom was working for Kimberly-Clark at the time. And Deming was also involved with helping them kind of lean and quick get quality improvement initiatives into their operation. That was... Gosh, I read that book. I think it was like the summer of 1988, but that was my first exposure to really getting understanding that quality truly is a process. So again, keep going as we segue into our industry here of how the quality movement began.
Well, it started to catch on then. We at that time when I got there, we had about 16 divisions. And so I had kind of like these labs, and I can tell you maybe Maybe four or five of them were really interested. And then there was four or five of them who wouldn't give you the time of day. And then there was maybe six or eight who, you know, thought, well, if Burgess thinks this is important, we probably ought to be interested. But they were, you know, they put a toe in the water. But those ones that were really interested, which was, you know, you had Chicago, Northern California division was really strong. Tucson, very strong. South Florida ones. So we had some divisions that were really open and willing to try things and experiment. And then there were other ones around the country that would at least, you know, make an attempt. And an interesting thing to me was my first year at the company, I'd say I couldn't figure out how we made any money. Because things were, and by the way, I had been with U.S. Steel out of college, and then after graduate school went to Motorola. So I had worked in two heavy duty manufacturing, one heavy manufacturing, the other, I mean, heavy duty. They made astounding amounts, billions and billions worth of product in semiconductors, you know, radios, sorts of things, very different industries. But I'd worked with some of the strongest manufacturing companies. U.S. Steel's quality wasn't anything to write home about, but Motorola's was. So when I got to Pulte, and by the way, as a consultant, I'd worked with some great companies. I worked with Caterpillar. I worked with Cummins Engine, John Deere. And those were early movers.
Yeah.
Well, when I, my first year at Pulte, I was like, how do we make any money? And then after a few more years, I started to understand how we made money until, at that time, I got so deep into the quality movement that I finally got to where I didn't know how we made any money again. We did, but we left a lot on the table. And you remember back in those years, and all builders did. And Pulte was at the top of the game compared to most of the national builders. Well, that progressed, and we just kept going around the country. And it was funny. The senior management team didn't like the idea of doing training. If we said we have training on quality, oh, man, that's a real hard sell. But, oh, we're going to do planning sessions on how we can bring all the resources of the division together to produce the best possible product for the customer at the best profit. Said, we're senior managers. We do planning. That's okay. But if I had called it training, I wouldn't have gotten any takers at the time. So we got them, the senior management teams on board through the planning sessions. Then we implemented, did you remember PQL1, PQL2?
Pulte Quality Leadership. I participated in that program, one of the best quality process improvement programs internal to an organization I've ever seen, Scott. That was an absolute phenomenal experience.
I still have a couple of the pins. And then I think, didn't you also participate in FQA, Field Quality Advisor?
Yep. I was involved in that as well. And again, just great training opportunities. What I loved about those things is that, like you mentioned, you came from all these other bigger industries, the Motorola's, the U.S. Steel's, and you were able, that was like the first transition of bringing outside talent in terms of large manufacturing footprint into the home building industry. And Pulte continued to bring in, like, I remember a marketing guy, we call him Chip, right? He was from Frito-Lay.
Yeah.
That guy. So, but that was what Pulte was doing. They were breaking this barrier of, you know, this old school way of building homes by bringing in other people like you. And it was absolutely just a wonderful experience because my background in TQM, Total Quality Management, I mean, I did my thesis on that and I got super excited that home builders were thinking along this way in the 90s already.
It was interesting that transition when we went then into the what we called Field Quality Advisor was a 2 full week process where the first week was learning all the tools of the quality movement and things like Pareto charts and histograms and scatter plots and how to really use data to understand what's really going on. The second week was in more. If you boil down to it, remember, it was more presentation skills, how to sell this internally to your company, to your division. So what happened then was now I left there in 97, in summer in 97, because, I had almost 9 years, really great years. But I decided I wanted to go out on my own and implement these things more broadly. And right at that point was when the first J.D. Power had come out. And J.D. Power, and I did this statistical technique you might remember called normalizing data, where you take all the data points and you set them from 0 to 100 so that you can understand them better. And it's a common, very legitimate statistical technique. So what I did was I took, and I remember I believe there were 28 of them. I should dig that out. It would be very interesting. There were 28 builders in the country at that time that had at least 3 divisions, distinct divisions. Now, today, there'd probably be 50 or 100 of them, but at that time there was 28 of them. And there was, the ones, at that time, Centex, who became Pentaparty, Pulte, Lennar, Richmond American was there then, the various ones that were, that you know, everybody knew. Pulte was always, during those years, first, second, or third, depending on whether you counted units or dollar volume. So J.D. Power came out. We took those scores and we normalized them from 0 to 100. Pulte was the highest, so they were the 100. And I won't say the name of the two companies that literally tied at zero. They were the lowest ones, so they were zero. And we distributed the other 28 in between there by the normalization technique. The next highest score to Pulte that first year of J.D. Power was 51.
Wow.
And that was Centex, which Pulte later acquired.
So Pulte was at 100, and the next one, the second best was 50% of that, roughly.
Yes.
Wow.
And people accused that Pulte and J.D. Power of cheating and stuff, and it was all a bunch of crap. You know, how J.D. Power got their data was they'd hire, mostly moms who wanted to do some part-time work, and they would go down to the courthouse and pull off the sales records of houses and which builder built them, and the addresses and the people's names. And then J.D. Power would take those and send direct to the customer the mail. It wasn't email then, the mail, to do the survey. And Pulte had, it didn't have anything to do with with saying who got the surveys, and they couldn't, there's no way to manipulate it. Now, you could get things like, do you remember if you used to go in car dealers and they'd say, I remember going to a dealer once and my wife had this this Jeep Liberty and taking it in for its like first service appointment. And the guy was a real nice guy. And he was talking about, his wife just had twins and all that, boy, kids are expensive. And he says, and by the way, here's your survey card. And if you'll fill this out right now, before you leave and give it back to us, we'll give you a free oil change for your next one. Well, and then they'd all then, then they could sort them, right? If they got a really bad one, they could throw that one out. And if people fill it out right in front of you,
you're not going to hurt somebody's feelings right in front of them.
We didn't find out an operation was attempting to do that, and that got shot down really fast. So anyway, it was legitimate. It was that good. And now in local markets, do you remember Lakewood in Chicago?
Yep.
Lakewood, they were a local builder, Buzz Hoffman.
Yep. Affordable single entry level.
Yeah. Entry level. They competed head to head with Pulte in Chicago. There were some markets where a really strong local builder beat Pulte, but Pulte would still be always one or two, rarely lower than three. But on a national basis, the builders that were of any size, Pulte was just head and shoulders above the industry and stayed that way for, it took about 4 or 5 years for other builders to really start catching up. So there was that time period in there where late 90s up until about 2000, where Pulte really had an edge on that. Now, J.D. Power, in the big housing crash, left the industry. And it's kind of too bad because we have data from J.D. Power all the way up to about 2009. And then it just stopped and they've never gone back to home building, which kind of surprises me that they haven't gone back, but be that as it may. So that's kind of how things really got going. We went out and then started working with a lot of different companies. We've worked with now about 275 companies. If you count divisions, major operations, it's about 385 of them in five different countries. So we've really been around and we do the quality work. You know, that's really melded in with this process of lean, L-E-A-N, lean. When you talk with builders, they think it's L-I-E-N, which isn't a good thing.
No, but not
L-E-A-N, a good thing. Which isn't doing anything cheap. It's, it's about never about dumbing down houses, but how do you really build a high quality home efficiently that is profitable for not just the builder, but for also for the suppliers and trades.
Thanks for listening to part one of this three-part episode with Scott Stamp. Join us for part two as we delve into how these principles apply to the housing industry.